Hi, this is the Aerotune podcast with Sebastian Schlurica and Bjorn Kafka, your podcast for aerodynamics and endurance training.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad to welcome you back to our Aerotune podcast today. Today's topic is the Ötztaler Radmarathon, and of course, we have our designated expert with us. Hello, Bjorn.
Hey, the expert is on board. Nothing can go wrong.
Very good. That's what we had in mind. This is a very special race, a really old race as well. Bjorn, tell us some facts about the race.
The Ötztaler Radmarathon was first held, I believe, in 1980, so it's been around for quite a few years. It's a tough race, usually 230 kilometers long, with 5,500 meters of elevation gain. Then there's another climb to over 2,470 meters at the Timmelsjoch Pass. Well, it gets a bit tight there with the air, and the weather naturally plays a role as well. The race starts very early in the morning, and it can be quite unpleasant.
Yes, those are some key facts, and today we want to tell you a bit about this cycling race, and we have Bjorn by our side, our designated expert in training. Bjorn, you usually train only professional athletes, especially in mountain biking, but also in other sports. By now, you have a little expertise in all of them. But tell us briefly about the Ötztaler Radmarathon Marathon. What are the biggest achievements your athletes have made in that race, and who were they?
Exactly. I work with many, many professionals, but I also work with regular people. A few of them. The Ötztaler was once held as a professional race. I don't remember who won, but otherwise, it's an amateur event. And Veronica Weiss came second, I believe, in 2020 or 2021, the year it was allowed to take place again after Corona. And Alban Licata came fourth in 2019. I think I worked with him back then. And well, a nice anecdote about Veronica Weiss. She unexpectedly came second. She participated just for fun to see what it was like. So the Ötztaler, this myth that lives within this cycling marathon, and the weather was terrible. She had headphones on, started off. It was cold. It was nasty. She even wanted to mount mudguards. And the worst, she said, was the descent to Ötz. Because at 60, 70 kilometers per h, people started taking off their rain jackets, and she was riding hands-free in a huge peloton. There are really a lot of riders, I think 5,000, 6,000, it's insane. And all she could think was, oh my God, everyone is going to crash. And then she kept riding, and at Jaufen Pass, I think she was fourth. And then they said, the third one is just up ahead, and she caught up with the third. And then they said, the second one is not far away either. And then she said, okay, now I'll give it a go. And she caught up with the second one, and she finished the race on the podium. A bit unexpected, and she said, sure, it's a commercial event, but you get so much. The roads are completely closed off. You only get that on a very high professional level. We're talking about huge stage races where everything is perfectly closed off, and that feeling of riding those insane passes without cars and going down as fast as possible without worrying about tractors. Coming around the corner, it's indescribable, a really great race.
Yes, it definitely makes you want more, and it's not long now. This weekend on Sunday, the Ötztaler Rad Marathon is already taking place, and accordingly, we won't have many more questions today about how to prepare optimally for this competition because you don't have much time left. You're probably already in the tapering phase or in recovery for this competition, but Bjorn will still be able to give you some tips and advice for the race and some special features, which we actually want to focus on now. Bjorn, how does it look? Give us a brief overview of the race. I believe you've ridden all the passes yourself. You haven't done the race itself yet, but you know it from your athletes, of course. Take us on a virtual tour and tell us what the athletes experience in this competition, where they go, what the peculiarities are at different points.
Well, my brain got a bit jumbled there. It starts, and the first climb is usually the Kutay. I think it's a very pleasant climb, especially because you're still fresh. You're cold, which means it also feels good when you ride a bit faster. Uphill, then you start to warm up. You ride up to almost 2,000 meters, and the air isn't a huge problem yet, at least for most people. There are also athletes who already have problems at 1,200 meters. You look at your heart rate, making sure it's in the GA2 tempo, and then you ride accordingly. The descent from Kutay is great. I like it a lot because it's very, very fast. I remember a Tour Transalp that I did many, many years ago. It was pouring rain, and you ride down at 90 kilometers per h or more. Then you lower your sunglasses a bit and look through a small slit between the frame and the lenses and tear down. Then you head towards Brenner. It's ideal to be in a group there because it's quite fast. This transfer section, let's say Brenner, for those who know it, it's not that high. You can roll over it quite comfortably. Then you go down again. Then comes Jaufenpass, another climb of almost 2,000 meters. It usually goes well, but you're already a bit tired there. Everything you've spent before on Kutai, or if you've pushed too hard on Brenner because you thought you had to lead the group, you'll notice it there. Then you go down again. And then comes the Schafrichter, as they say, the Timmelsjoch. It goes up to 2,500 meters, and you will definitely feel the altitude. Usually I feel it at 2,000 meters, that I already have trouble maintaining power. And then you have to make compromises in your performance. You can calculate it wonderfully. There's a formula for how much power loss you have after adaptation or without adaptation, and then you can easily subtract around 10% if you're riding well there, especially. Not at threshold, especially not at such a long distance, but then you're riding at GA2 sweet spot tempo at most, and then you can easily subtract 10%, and then you're only riding at around 70% of your threshold power if you're not adapted, and then you go down and then you're pretty much there. Yes, that's roughly the virtual ride. Okay.
That was a highly condensed version. Tell me, how long do the top athletes take to finish the race?
They finish in just under 7 hours, so if you finish in under 8 hours, you're really a machine. You're in good shape.
What about the hobby athletes? If they're not optimally prepared due to limited time, how long does it take them?
It depends on the weather. Yeah, somewhere between 9 and 10 hours. It's really a long race.
There's a lot to experience on a day like that. Can you briefly tell us how to best behave at the start? I mean, there are many riders starting at the same time. The atmosphere will be very heated, charged up, and maybe even a bit more motivated to start faster than originally planned is quite good. How do you clarify that with your athletes? How do you manage to prevent them from overpacing in the beginning?
Yes, you have to kind of, it's a cost-benefit analysis, yes. So if you ride a little faster in the Kutail, then you have the advantage of being in a good group at the Brenner Handler and maybe saving a bit of energy there, yes. I would say you can still sustain a performance in terms of carbohydrate intake so that you don't necessarily go into a huge deficit, yes. Let's say you can still ingest around 90, 100, 120 grams of carbohydrates, which means you're riding a bit in the sweet spot. Yes, maybe a bit below sweet spot. Then you're definitely safe from depleting too many carbohydrates, but still have caught a good group. That's how I would do it. Yes, you can calculate it very well with us, but above all, and this is a bit of a mental thing, I would already consume maximum nutrition in the Kutail. You start off, and then it goes down a bit, and then you simply forget to eat. You feel good, you start going fast, and actually you have to say, okay, in the first 15 minutes, you start eating again. Yes, keep eating, 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 so that you have enough carbohydrates stored up there, ingested, then it goes into the descent, and there you won't be able to eat anymore because you're going too fast. But you already know that you didn't exhaust yourself in the Kutail. The carbohydrates are there because you'll need them. Kutail is really just an initial entry point. Yes, that's the first part.
Two very important aspects come up here. One is the tactics, meaning you would definitely focus on getting into the right group. So also consider that it's most sensible to ride the race with a group that reflects your own pace. So position yourself correctly. Wait for the right group. That's one aspect that I find interesting. Maybe you can say something more about it. And the other aspect is the nutrition strategy. We definitely need to talk more about that because the race stands and falls with it. But nutrition is extremely important over such a long period of time. And as you mentioned, when you have the descents where you can't refuel, where you might not pedal as much, where you might start to feel cold because it's still early in the morning and not yet warm, we also need to talk about clothing and clothing strategies. So tell us first, how important is it to have the right group on that day?
The right group is especially important after the Kutail. This transfer section up to the Brenner, and also the Brenner in the group. I mean, you're naturally riding over 20 kilometers per h, and aerodynamics are really interesting at slow speeds. And if you're riding as a lone fighter because you either missed a good group or because you think, I'm so strong I'll blast everything from the front, then you're wasting unnecessary energy in the form of carbohydrates, and you will definitely need them for the next three climbs that are coming. So you have to decide for yourself, do I go a bit faster, catch a good group, or do I let myself fall back? You can also say, after the descent to the Kutail, okay, I'll just wait, look back and see, okay, there's a big group coming. Instead of pushing myself to the limit up there alone in the wind, I'll just wait. And we know ourselves how much energy you save when you're in the back. You're always 40% more relaxed. You need that later. So always wait during this phase.
So it's recommended for everyone, also because you might not be interested in doing this race all by yourself. You would want to take the right group and save energy in the flat sections and then have the energy for the climbs. That's definitely a good thing and it saves a lot of time. In such a long race, I think you should just take every opportunity you have. Okay, that's clear. Now tell us about carbohydrate intake. How many carbohydrates, let's say, for an athlete who is significantly stronger, who finishes in about 8 hours or just under 8 hours, how many carbohydrates does he consume in a day like that?
You're looking at about 1 kilogram. 1 kilogram, so 1,000 grams of carbohydrates. Would that be like eating 6 packs of Haribo?
6 packs of Haribo. Would you do that in a race, eat 6 packs of Haribo?
We actually have a little anecdote about our friend Jamie Loudon from Wattshop, who rode the race through the Pyrenees. That's an extreme race, yes, going through the Pyrenees once and back. He was in the lead, but he had to give up because he ate so many Haribos that they caused him stomach problems, yes, and also his jaw. So I wouldn't do that for days on end. I wouldn't eat Haribos, yes. The race is too demanding for that. And when you push yourself closer to your limit, and your breathing is already affected, you won't be swallowing any Haribos. So I would go for gels and bars maybe, because the load isn't that high. So you can still digest them well at the beginning, not necessarily a whole grain bar, but rather a shredded one, and in the bottles, at least in the first bottles that you can take with you, because you can't carry something all the time, something high energy like maltodextrin, fructose, Vitago, the classics, right?
Okay, what about if I make my own nutrition? How does that work? What's important in the drinks? What should not be missing? For example, salt, how does that work?
Electrolytes, definitely, yes, it has to be included. It always depends on how much you sweat, what kind of sweat rate you have, and especially what electrolyte content you have. That can be tested. It also shifts depending on how long you've been in the heat. So we've had a phase now where the last few days here in Munich, and it's not that far away from the Ötztal, we've had a few days that weren't that hot, around 23, 24 degrees. But it will get really hot again by the weekend, around 31 to 33 degrees, at least here in Munich. That means you have an extremely high sweat rate, and I would add a bit more salt. So if you already have an electrolyte drink, I would say, add a pinch of salt to your 750 milliliters. Maybe salt tablets, there are different manufacturers. It definitely makes sense to take something extra on such a long route. So, take about 12, 13 salt tablets with you. Keep them in the jersey pocket in a small bag, and take one or two every 2 hours, depending on what the manufacturer recommends. And I believe most people don't know their personal electrolyte content in sweat, but it becomes noticeable relatively quickly, like slight cramps. All these things become noticeable. For example, frequent urination. Frequent urination, definitely. So if you have to pee all the time, it means there's an imbalance in your electrolyte levels, right?
So in that case, what could be a possible reaction if you have salt tablets with you? Could that be an option if you feel slight cramps or if you have to urinate frequently to counteract it with something like that?
Yes, definitely. I had Daniel Steinhauser, who finished third in the race across the Alps. We noticed that he wasn't taking in enough water anymore. And it was extremely hot, but he didn't feel like eating the salt tablets and such. It's also a bit difficult to counteract it then. He ate chips. They gave him chips from the car. It worked too. That's also a mental aspect. Do you feel like it? All right, in the Ötztal, you'll still be fine if you're out there for 8, 9, 10 hours. But in an extreme race where you're out there for 24 hours, you won't feel like that anymore. And you'll need something savory. So you might grab some chips or salami. So definitely counteract it when you notice it. Loss of concentration, frequent urination, mild cramping, definitely need to adjust electrolytes.
Yes, okay, now we've basically started. We're currently going through our checklist. We talked about trying to ride in groups, especially at the beginning, so that we can get to the finish line smoothly. Exactly. And the other thing we discussed was the nutrition strategy, paying attention to electrolytes. Now the question is, if you could give a gram amount per hour, how many carbohydrates should I try to consume? We heard about the 6 packets. Yes, what would you say is possible? Yes, how many grams per hour could I intake?
It depends on how well you've trained for it. It's naive to believe that if I only eat 40 grams during training, I can then consume 120 grams during the race. You will definitely have stomach problems, especially if you also consume high amounts of fructose, for example, energy drinks mixed with a ratio of 2 to 1, maltodextrin and fructose. I would be cautious there. 90 grams is generally manageable. You can usually handle that quite well. But for those who haven't tested it before and have consumed high amounts of carbohydrates, they should be a bit more cautious and not say, I'll go with 100 or 120 grams. 90 grams should work. If you experience problems, then reduce the carbohydrates a bit. Problems meaning bloated stomach, stomach cramps, and so on. In that case, you should reduce the energy intake a bit. Maybe also have an emergency bar with you, like a classic oat bar. That can help with any stomach cramps during the day. And of course, there are carbohydrates that I would generally say don't consume too much of. For example, dextrose tends to draw a lot of water into the intestines. That can cause problems. So it's better to go for something like maltodextrin, which is safer, or even Vitargo, for example.
What about the nutrition provided by the organizer? Is that a good option? Can you get by with it?
That's the only way to do it. Most likely they have good feeding stations, as the Ötztaler Radmarathon is known for that. You can replenish yourself with energy drinks and such there, but I would definitely have some things in my cycling jersey that I know are safe and will work well for me.
So definitely plan a strategy for when and how much carbohydrates you want to consume. Keep in mind that you should have already consumed enough carbohydrates by the time you reach the first climb because, as Bjorn mentioned earlier, eating during the descent is not possible. And now another question. When I'm standing at the start in the morning, what about my clothing? What should I pay attention to when starting this race? What do I absolutely need to have with me?
Well, we start in the morning, it's cold, and we'll be climbing to 2,500 meters, so it can be really cold up there. On a day like today, this weekend most likely, the weather will be good, so it won't be that dramatic. But definitely take a wind vest with you. I'm a big fan of GABA, for example, Castelli's material, or Perfetto. Those work really well in most cases. There's a new company called Van Dyke that also makes such a membrane, which is even lighter, more breathable, and more waterproof. Both options are excellent, but a vest is a must, arm warmers too, especially when going downhill fast, and gloves depending on the situation. Personally, I like to wear gloves because I have a problem with my fingers turning white at high speeds, and then I lose all feeling because my fingers used to get damaged during a very cold bike ride a few years ago. Leg warmers depending on preference, but never make the mistake of not bringing anything. Cooling down during a ride can really exhaust you, especially when you're at your energy limit and also when going downhill. If you start shivering, which is not uncommon, it's also a safety aspect. It's better to be a bit too warm than too cold. Overshoes, depending on the situation, if it's wet, I would definitely put something on. There are these rubber things from Velo Toast that I find quite practical. They keep everything out, fit snugly, and are somewhat aerodynamic, and maybe also a cycling cap if you want.
Okay, now we've already packed quite a lot in our virtual backpack, so to speak, on how to prepare for the race. Now, of course, a very interesting question. What about the pacing strategy? I think that's also something highly interesting. There are pacing strategies where I try to pace myself based on heart rate. I could pace myself based on power. And then there's often a focus on FTP, which represents the power output that can be sustained for an hour. But for those who know us well, they know that FTP only represents one aspect, namely the power I can generate in an hour, and not necessarily the power I can sustain for 5, 9, or 10 hours. So tell us a few words in general about how I should pace myself and why it's better to know metrics such as VO2 max and VLAMAX, which are new modern metrics for determining performance.
Well, these metrics are not really new. When I think of FTP, for example, 20-minute tests, I believe they are younger than VLAMAX and VO2 max models. The problem, or the beauty, of course, is that doing a 20-minute test and taking 95% of that is very simple. Anyone can do it. The disadvantage is that it doesn't represent your maximum oxygen consumption or your lactate threshold, so the value can vary significantly. There are pacing calculators, even Excel spreadsheets, where you can enter your FTP and it tells you how many watts you should ride. Which is great, someone put a lot of effort into it, but it only works to some extent. If I have a high VULA max, meaning I have a high carbohydrate consumption, then I will definitely go harder. but I can also easily underpace myself if, for example, let's say an athlete only has a VO2 max of 60, but has a very efficient lactate threshold of 0.3. They can ride much faster and won't get tired as quickly. It all depends on how many carbohydrates I burn during the race, and if I know I have a low VULA max, then I can go faster. That's why FTP is a difficult topic, especially for this race.
Yes, that was already clear to our listeners, but for those who may be tuning in for the first time, the FTP doesn't represent both systems separately, the aerobic and anaerobic systems. As Bjorn just nicely said, if the anaerobic system is highly developed, you will consume significantly more carbohydrates at the given FTP levels, and then you won't reach the finish line as you imagine. And that could be the key for you at this point. If you notice that something doesn't fit with the FTP, something isn't right, then that could be the key for you to make progress. In that case, you should definitely take a look at VO2 max, VLAMAX, and our power test, for example. But there are also other labs that offer such tests because they reflect your metabolic profile much better. And then you can create much better pacing strategies, for example, with our simulation software, where you can see where to invest your energy to achieve the best possible time. It also shows you how many carbohydrates you consume, when to stop pedaling, when to focus more on aerodynamics during a descent, and how much effort to put in when climbing or riding on flat terrain. All of that comes out of it, and you even have the option to download it as an export file to your Garmin device, for example, so you have the pacing strategy right there. On your watch, that is probably the best thing you can do. Bjorn has already achieved good success with his athletes, for example, in Race Across Italy and other races. So this is definitely a real added value if you don't have that now. Then let's try to figure out what would be the best option. Let's assume, and now come the tricky questions. I have an FTP of 300 watts. How should I climb the mountain?
Honestly, I would primarily look at your heart rate. What does your FTP tell you? That's your mechanical power. But you don't get any response. You don't get any answer about what your body is actually doing. And we can find out quite well through your heart rate. And what does your heart rate tell you? You probably have some idea of where your heart rate is when you've been riding at 300 watts for a while. Let's say you ride 20 minutes at 300 watts. Then, you know, okay, I usually ride at around 180 beats per minute, to put it simply. I wouldn't ride like that in a race. I would say ride about 10% less. So you would be around 160, maybe even lower, 155 at the beginning, and I would stay in this range the whole time. Then your heart rate will quickly tell you if you go over it. So if at some point in the race you're riding and pushing as hard as you can and your heart rate doesn't go up anymore, it means that everything is already too late, because most likely you are glycogen depleted. You can't reach your threshold power anymore. You don't have enough stored carbohydrates, and your heart rate won't increase anymore. Another phenomenon is when you notice your heart rate goes a bit higher. You've been riding for about 2-2.5 hours, and you notice, oh, now it's getting a bit tougher, I have a little step, maybe 5-8% more. That's also an indication that your glycogen stores are running low. You have a higher fat metabolism. Your heart rate goes a bit higher. You need more oxygen for beta oxidation, which is the fat metabolism. You need more oxygen. And that's also an indication that something is going wrong. You have too few stored carbohydrates. Another thing is, when it gets hot, your heart rate goes a bit higher. Also an indication that you need to do something. So in a race, because we have so many variables that can influence, I wouldn't necessarily just rely on watts, especially if I haven't ridden for that long before. I would say, look at your heart, see what works. Ultimately, the final climb decides, especially when we go into the mountains, so look at your heart and eat, classic. That's how I would do it.
Okay, that's definitely a good tip to orient yourself according to your heart rate. For those who possibly know their VO2 max and VLAMAX, it would be recommended to come to the platform, do a simulation. Then you'll get the best power profile you can have for the race. That's definitely, because it's the most meaningful way to know how much energy you should invest, and we calculate how many carbohydrates you have available to you. You can also determine how many carbohydrates you want to consume per hour. You also have the option to represent different CDA values for, if you know them, for descents or uphill sections or even flat stages, if you ride in different positions, and then you get a very detailed simulation provided for your race. Now, we've talked about that. Now, we have another component that we haven't considered yet, so we know something about clothing. We know something about pacing strategy. We know something about nutrition. How about the mental aspect? Can you take us through that? You already mentioned that this is maybe something to discuss before we talk about the mental aspect. And this also belongs to the mental aspect. Now you realize, hey, my heart rate isn't going up anymore. Or you realize what Bjorn just said, it's actually significantly higher at the threshold power than I'm used to. Does it then make sense, for example, at these points to say, okay, let me take a short break. Let me focus on my nutrition and try to get into a stable state before I continue working at this limit? Or would you say, no, you have to push through?
Yes, it depends. It depends on what type of cyclist you are. There are those classic stubborn ones who just keep pushing. They don't care. But in such a long race, that can also backfire. So I would say there needs to be a bit of a flexible state. So if I see that my heart rate is going a bit higher, I don't need to panic immediately. I need to say, okay, my body is reacting somehow, which is normal when I've been riding for so long. Maybe I ate something that didn't sit well, so I'll eat a little bit more. I make sure that the heart rate doesn't go much higher, but it's a bit of a limit. I allow myself a bit of a range. I see that I have some amplitude, 5%, up and down, everything's safe. So stay cool. Really think about what happens when something goes wrong. How do I get out of it? Never panic. It doesn't help. I mean, after 8 or 9 hours or 7 hours of riding, even the pros, 7 hours, so much can still go well or so much can be lost if you make a mistake. So stay relaxed. Think of something nice, as silly as it sounds. Talk positively to yourself, and it's like this. It has always helped me as a racer. All those who are riding, it's already hurting them, especially at the end. All those who are riding, they would like to ride faster, but they don't. So everyone suffers equally, and that has helped me a lot. And it's also great in a marathon that you're somehow struggling and persevering together and thinking positively. It may sound a bit silly and simple, but don't despair because it hurts right now, and it will hurt. Yes, that's completely normal. I think where it gets ugly.
Exactly, and there are different studies, and there's the central governor, for example, an entity within you that knows exactly about your energy metabolism, about you. It's aware. And one thing is, and we all know this, when the question comes up, why am I even doing this? It's often the question that your central governor asks you is, how important is what's happening here right now? Because you're energetically at your limit, and this question needs to be answered, and it's not made easy for you. So it has to be very important to you for you to keep going at this level. And you can also relate to these questions. So when these questions pop up in you, like, why am I doing this and why am I even here? Then you can simply interpret it as, hey, I'm currently at my limit. Maybe I'll take a short break. Maybe I'll focus more on my nutrition just to get out of this tunnel vision. And usually I feel better afterwards, but it certainly depends on where you are in the race. If you're really close to the finish line, you can push through it because the race is still very long. If you still have half of it ahead of you, like in the Ottstaler, if you still have to ride for another 5 hours and you're already seed, then it might make sense to take a little break and then start again. Quickly focus on carbohydrates, get out of the hole, and then often talk about getting a second wind, which brings much more fun to ride with, the second wind than to be in this polar state all the time. And that's just a small anecdote from me, how I always felt when I did long-distance triathlons. Pay attention to your body sensations, and then you will find a way to decipher them and know what your body is trying to communicate to you.
Yeah, well, I'm there, I do. Another one. Maybe it's not the mentally healthiest way. For me, it's like war. When I ride like that, or when I used to ride like that, my God, now I can't do that anymore. But when I was racing, I just had to roll over to the next one, simple as that. Yeah, so I mechanically stuffed food and drink into me. I even set a timer, although in a real road race. It was difficult. I always, whenever I saw someone drinking, I immediately drank as well because I thought, okay, now I have to. And I always wanted to be in the front. It was like an instinct that I still have sometimes. That means when I take my children to school or pick them up with the cargo bike and someone overtakes me, I have to catch up with them. And it's like when you're at war. You become a warrior. It's bad, yes, you're not supposed to say that, but that's the strategy that worked for me, that I cling to something, and it wasn't about just making it to the next turn, but catching up with the guy up front with the bulging calf vein. I have to catch up with him now, otherwise it won't work. And that's how I struggled through it.
Of course, yes, I mean, that's without a doubt. The will to win and the fight for it, I remember, it's interesting, because I always ask myself the question, am I maybe faster in the end? If I take a short break to effectively refuel and then be significantly faster because I've gotten out of that extreme hunger. And the worst thing I experienced, for example, was during the very first Ironman, where I had very poor nutrition, and afterwards I had such a strong days I was running and I wanted to shift gears because the gear shift lever was up, and I was looking for that gear shift lever and I couldn't find it, until at some point it dawned on me, hey man, I'm running, there's no gear. And that was the moment when I realized, okay, now I have to dramatically change something here, and I wasn't fast anymore. And then I stopped at the next aid station, poured cola down my throat as much as I could. And 15 minutes later, I came back to life. I noticed the world around me again, which was somehow there, and I ran significantly faster. Yes. So at that point, I was pretty sure that taking that break ultimately led to me becoming faster overall. And I don't think it would have been effective for me to continue suffering at that point. Yes, and keep torturing myself, but it was reasonable, and I am convinced that I was simply faster overall because I also really pushed myself there. It was a sensible decision from a retrospective perspective, because my split times per kilometer while running, I was a minute faster per kilometer afterwards compared to before while running. So that was at kilometer 20, so I still had...
That's always the feeling when you've really pushed yourself to the extreme and you feel so light. Drunk, yeah, you can have that cheaper by just chugging a bottle. Other people run marathons or do Ironman, maybe that's more sensible.
But let's get back to the Ötztaler Rad Marathon. Before we come to an end, I have here a list of 15 questions that ChatGPT provided. He searched the web and prepared questions for us from the web, and we're doing this. Like this, I will now ask you these questions, and as a special challenge for you, please answer with just one sentence. Oh yes, this won't work, and some questions are no longer so urgent, but may be interesting for the preparation for next year. Interesting, I'll go through the list, try to keep it as brief as possible. It won't always be feasible, but give it a try. I'll start with the first. Question: what should the ideal training look like before the Ötztaler Rad Marathon? How many hours and what type of training session per week are recommended?
I need two sentences for that. First, build the engine. That means increase V2 max. Then train specifically. Adapt V2 max. That means also train intervals that I ride for the Ötztaler G2 tempo, sweet spot tempo.
How many hours per week?
10 to 20. Okay, so you should definitely do that. With less it gets ugly. So I would have at least 1 week where I ride 20 hours, just to get used to that distance. There are two rides of 6 hours in there.
Okay, second question. How can you improve the aerodynamics on your bike without compromising comfort or power transfer?
Clothing, tight clothing, good helmet, tight vest, that's it. And maybe do an aero test on the road bike to know how aerodynamic I sit on the flats.
And when descending, is there anything special I could pay attention to?
Find a position that is safe enough so that you're still fast. I wouldn't start lying on the top tube or putting the saddle on my belly. That's just extremely dangerous. So really, make yourself into a ball, but still have a good view of the road.
Okay, next question. What role do VO2 max and VLAMAX play in the preparation for the Ötztaler Rad Marathon? How can these values be optimized?
These are several questions, extremely important. VO2. Max is very dominant at the beginning. The engine must be big. I would make sure to start working on VLAMAX for the Ötztaler about 2.5 months in advance, namely lowering it, really lowering it. It can be really low, like 0.3 or something, towards long distance. Also long-distance triathlon, then you ride well and safe.
What are the most common mistakes athletes make in the preparation and execution of the Ötztaler Rad Marathon, and how can they be avoided?
The most common mistakes in training are not riding long enough, not daring to approach the distance in training, being undernourished during training, especially in the direct preparation. That means sticking to such a ridiculously low intake, like 40 grams for an insanely long time. While it may lower lactate production, which may make sense, you also have to get used to very high carbohydrate amounts. 2 weeks before the race at the latest, that's when you need to start loading up properly and in the race, starting too fast and eating too little. Those are the main things.
Next question. How can you effectively prepare for the different weather conditions you might experience during the race?
Have the right clothing with you, the best, maybe a GABA or other things. We've already discussed that.
What specific nutrition strategies do you recommend during training and during the race itself?
In training, first of all, during the initial phase when we build VO2 max, always supply with carbohydrates, then when I lower VLAMAX, maybe reduce it a bit. That means also endurance pace or GA2 pace, maybe a little, running on empty. but then get used to high carbohydrate amounts at least 2 weeks before the race, maybe even 3 weeks, so that the carbohydrate in jam is definitely guaranteed. What else was there? Was there anything else? Well, that is, during the race, then. Just give it everything you've got.
Exactly, we talked about that, also about tactics. If you consume too many carbohydrates, Bjorn said a few things about that, so you should follow that. How can you optimize body weight to improve performance? Does that make sense? What does a kilogram of weight do on a racing bike?
It depends on how fit you are. We have already simulated that. I think we were at 1.5 minutes. With 1 kilogram, 2 minutes with the fast athlete, around 8 hours.
And with the slow athletes, who take around 10 hours, slower athletes, it's significantly more, between 3 and 4 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Was that per 1,000 meters of elevation gain, or? No, per total distance, exactly. Per total distance, I calculated that based on my body weight and my old body weight when I used to race. And then, hold on tight, I came up with 85 minutes, and that is, of course, tough, right? Especially now that I weigh 20 kilograms more than before. But I also don't look like I don't eat anything anymore. Yes, so weight definitely matters. Sense. But thinking about weight now is just totally nonsensical. Weight reduction should start at least 2 weeks before the race. After that, you shouldn't try to lose weight anymore.
Then there was another question. How should the intervals between hard training sessions and rest periods look like to avoid overtraining and still ensure optimal preparation?
Yeah, I would say do a power test. Look at the chart. It tells you exactly how many minutes you should spend in each zone per week. If you do everything right, it's pretty awesome.
Then we have the mental strategies. So what mental strategies can help deal with the challenges during the marathon? We discussed 2 strategies. One is reflecting on what's happening and relating to it. The other is to fight it and simply see that you can overcome it. Are there any other mental strategies that you might also use with your athletes or with mental coaches for your athletes?
Yeah, there is a strategy that works well, which I like to do with a world-class cross-country rider, is to try to reflect or withdraw into a scene that you have already experienced, which was negatively charged but had a positive outcome. Yeah, something like, I crashed, I dropped back to 20th position, but at the end of the day, I still made it to the podium, and recalling that in a difficult situation during the race, like I've experienced something similar before, I'll get through it too. Again, it helps immensely. And also before the race, I had already thought about, if there was any scene ideally related to this sport, I once crashed, or I once had a terrible bonk where I felt much worse, I got out of it again, having that in mind and saying, okay, if something bad happens, like a weak phase, I'll say, okay, I've been there before. I've already been through something like this. I'll get through it again.
Then what equipment, type of bike, tire choice, clothing would you recommend for the Ötztaler Radmarathon?
We've already discussed clothing a bit. What about you? What do you wear? We're not advertising, but I would go for a Conti tubeless or a Victoria Corsa tubeless or with latex. Those would be my 2 favorites to ride.
And what about wheels? Anything to consider? Are disc brakes useful? Disc brakes.
Definitely, especially when it's really wet. They might be a bit heavier and maybe not as aerodynamic, but I mean, that's very homeopathic, but you can brake much better with them. And wheels, yeah, not too high, yeah, like 30 millimeters, something like that. Light and stiff, tire width. Do you have any ideas about that? 23, 25, 28, if I remember correctly. 25 is standard. If the road conditions aren't great, 28. So I would definitely go with 28.
Okay, then we have the pacing strategy. We've already talked about that. Then another question. You mentioned it briefly at the very beginning. How do you deal with the altitude and the associated physical changes?
Altitude is, well, that's actually a topic we need to discuss in detail. We saw that. Yesterday, the Tour of Austria is currently taking place. Jonas Rapp won the Glockner. King, which is practically the prestigious prize at this race, or, in Austria, he's almost the national champion again. And we prepared for that, going up the Glockner at 25, and he was at altitude. That was the first thing. We specifically prepared for that, and before that, you usually do a blood test, checking things like iron, ferritin, B12, those things. So altitude preparation can definitely be useful, as silly as it sounds, for a race like this. You suffer less, you're significantly faster. So it can be managed well when you then actually reach altitude. Don't be alarmed. Performance will decrease. You'll have a higher breathing rate. Your heart rate will go higher. It won't necessarily reach the maximum, but the heart rate will simply go higher. The air pressure is lower. Less air is pushed into your lungs, so you have to breathe a bit more and faster. So don't be alarmed. Performance decreases at 1.8. It starts slowly, and then it significantly goes higher, and you can lose about 10-15%. So keep in mind that if you normally ride at 300 watts and suddenly only manage 220 or 240, that's completely normal. Okay, then next.
Question. What techniques for uphill and downhill riding are most effective for the different sections? Are there any special turns where you should pay attention?
Well, I would never brake before the turn. So you have the speed you want to achieve. In the turn, you already have that. Brake before and then roll through. So don't start braking in the turn. If it's wet, you'll crash into it. Then you naturally look where you want to go. So where is the point in the turn where I want to come out in the end? And of course, you briefly look at the turn. Where am I going there so that nothing is in the way? And then you focus on the point. You want to reach and automatically steer towards it. Because if you start focusing on your front wheel and wobbling around the turn, you'll just go straight. That's when a high wheel doesn't make sense. It has so much mass, it sometimes just pushes you straight. That's the first thing about downhill riding. Uphill, high cadence, always high cadence. We use a lot more slow muscle fibers. We need those towards the end. It's not a two-hour race, and if you run out of them because you've been pedaling too hard, then the muscle fibers get tired, and it will get a bit harder towards the end, so preferably 90, but that's obviously difficult at altitude or with the gradients, but 85 would be good. Heart rate will go a bit higher, of course. You need more oxygen, but always high cadence, always high.
Now we're at question 14 of the penultimate one. How can you best recover from the marathon afterwards?
Enough carbohydrates, enough protein. Also give yourself enough time to recover. So, you're pretty exhausted for a few days. I wouldn't do nothing a little bit. Maybe nothing on the first or second day, but I wouldn't say you lie down for a week because your blood vessels drop or you always feel sluggish and need 3, 4, 5, 6 espressos just to get through the day. Do a little bit of movement, ride. For about 3 or 4 hours, go for a walk. Maybe do an easy jog if you want. Not as many. Muscle fibers get damaged. It's not like a marathon where you're completely destroyed afterwards, but do a little something. Consume 2 grams per kilogram of body weight, protein per day, and usually it works out fine.
Okay, and now we come to the last question, which unfortunately, due to time constraints, cannot be implemented, but still, let's ask it again. Does it make sense to train strength exercises or weightlifting specifically for the long-distance cycling marathon?
In the winter, it definitely makes sense to work on leg alignment, leg stability, and correct any imbalances. Afterwards, it's better to refrain from it. Maybe just do maintenance sets once a week and things like that. But nowadays we have such great gear ratios. Nobody needs to ride with a 39, 23, or 25 or so like when I used to race. That was the best we had. I mean, at 39, 25, going uphill was already hell. But even then, we didn't do any strength training. So, in my opinion, use a lower gear, a smaller ratio, and definitely focus on strength training in the winter and not look completely exhausted like a question mark.
Okay, then we've gone through the 15-point list. Today, we virtually went through the Ötztaler Rad Marathon with Bjorn. We looked at different aspects, including mental training, nutrition, pacing, clothing, equipment, etc. We hope that we have entertained you with this and given you some valuable tips so that you can have a successful race. It can, of course, be applied to any other cycling marathon race, what we discussed today, and then we wish you strong legs, a clear mind, and we look forward to your stories. Because you can gladly write them to the podcast if something particularly resonated with you or if something was helpful. We would be very happy to receive feedback from you. And yes, we will continue with the next podcast soon. Do you have anything else to add, Bjorn?
No, actually nothing. All good. So go fast and have fun. See you later. Bye-bye. Bye.